Hello. Hello, everybody. My name is Wojciech Siemaszkiewicz, and I am a curator of the West Slavic Collection and the Slavic and Baltic Division, which is located in room 217. I am also a co-curator of the Graphic Modernist exhibition that you could see upstairs. There's also a small exhibition in the room 217 of the Czech Modernist books, if you'd like to see them. Today we're going to see the lecture by Professor Rose Caron Walsh-Malone, who is a professor of history of art in the Graduate Center, City University of New York, and she has published extensively on Kandinsky and constructivist books, and that's the topic that she chose today, I believe. So please welcome Professor Walsh-Malone.
Thank you for the introduction. Can you all hear me? Okay, good. I'm very pleased to be here today to talk about international constructivism and the artists' books. Works by two of the artists reading from your left to right, the Russian Elazitsky and the Hungarian Laszlo Moholy Nagy, are in the wonderful exhibition Graphic Modernism that you just heard about. And some of you may have even looked at it before descending to the auditorium. Works by a third artist, the Russian Alexander Rodchenko, who's on your very right, will also be included in this lecture, as they are significant for understanding how constructivism pushed aside painting in favor of the graphic arts and photography, an emphasis that is still felt in the visual arts today. To explore this privileging of graphic design during the 20s, as constructivism became international, moving from Soviet Russia westward to Germany and the rest of Europe, I plan to discuss three books by each of these artists. On the left, Luzitsky's For the Voice from 1923, in the center, Rodchenko's About This of 1923, and in your lower right, Moholy Nagy's Painting, Photography, and Film, first published in 1925 and known primarily from its second edition of 1927, which appears, the reproduction of this appears on the screen. Now, to understand the term constructivism, we must go back to the first years after the Russian Revolution of October 1917, which overthrew the system of autocratic rule in Russia. As the Bolsheviks, for as we know, is that political group that engineered the October Revolution, as the Bolsheviks gathered power, they stressed the importance of organizations by professional groups. Indeed, Lenin urged artists to assist with the education of the people and to transmit communist ideas by inventing new forms and using contemporary industrial material. And young artists earnestly labored to form organizations and schools which could help to create a new visual culture for the new political system. Now, one such group was organized in Vitebsk, now in Belarus, but then in Russia. And we see the artist L. Luzitsky on your very right, and he's the slightly balding man on the very right. And this is a photo from 1920. As he's sitting around a table with other male and female artists, and you might notice they're in massive overcoats because the problems with fuel were enormous right after the revolution. But there they are planning the curriculum for this critical undertaking of making a new visual culture. Now, one of the experimental artists called to Vitebsk was Kazimir Malevich, whom we see in the image on your left. And he is the man pointing to a banner filled with a geometric abstract square. One of the signs he believed could assist in the remaking of the new Soviet person. And in that photograph, which is from 1920, we actually see Malevich with a group of students from Vitesse getting on a train and going to St. Petersburg with examples of the new art. Now, Leszczynski had called upon the older artist to bring his ideas and his primitive paintings to Vitesse. And we see on the screen two of the large oils which Malevich called suprematism, beginning in 1915. They have large, colorful, geometric shapes floating against a white background. And they're very unlike the art privileged by the former czar, the former ruler in Russia, who favored academic realistic painting. These works by Malevich were meant to evoke, through the placement of irregular overlapping geometric forms at angles to the picture plane, an illusion of space as a vision of a new world beyond the ordinary. In the aftermath of the revolution, Malevich and many others felt this use of geometric, abstract, hard-edged, almost mechanical-like forms could even be a visual reminder of the industrialization that was desperately needed if the Soviet Union was to modernize. Now, after 1917, Malevich had begun to apply his abstract geometric shapes to making logos and insignia for some of the committees that were being formed to transform the country. And his work is on the left, and it's a design, actually, I'm just showing the envelope, for the Committee on Rural Poverty. And this design dates from 1918. And you can see that he is using the same geometric abstract forms as the logo for this Committee on Rural Poverty. Now, other young artists took their lead from Malevich and used his geometric abstract forms for posters, proclaiming, as the one on your right, done in 1919 by the young woman artist Varvara Stepanova, who wrote, "The future is our only goal." At least that's what the poster was meant to proclaim. And this is just a design itself for the poster. But the importance, again, is noticing how the language is derived from Malevich's belief in the power of abstract forms to communicate. Now, Leszczynski himself produced several exemplary works in 1919, informed by Malevich's approach. And he turned away from his expressionist inflected interpretations, which you see in the upper image. If we look at the two bottom images, we see on the left a black and white photo from the actual time of a large billboard, which he designed, calling out to the workers to come to the factories where workbenches awaited them. The power of the brightly colored poster that he designed on the right, called "Beat the Whites with the Red Wedge," is partially the result of the placement of the dagger-like red triangular wedge into the white circle. And Leszczynski also added clear, mechanically-looking letters to reinforce the didactic message of the Red Army beating the white supporters of the Tsar in this graphic work, which was meant for reproduction. After all, as early as 1917, Lenin had asked the artists to support communism by becoming agitators for the new communist state. In Moscow, another group, the Institute of Artistic Culture, that had come together after the revolution to reform art education, also took up the concept of abstract painting using geometric forms, believing that these forms represented the triumph of the new over old ways of the monarchy. And on your left is an oil painting by Alexander Rodchenko of 1920 called Linear Composition, in which the artist has experimented with using an engineer's protractor to make perfectly rounded circles in white against a black background. Now, working with his wife, whose poster you had previously seen, his wife Stepanova, and other young artists, they all wanted to more directly emphasize their contribution to the building of the new Soviet visual culture. And they began to design or to construct three-dimensional works using the principles found in geometric abstract painting. And on the right is a photo of Rodchenko from 1920-21, and he's behind one of his three-dimensional sculptures or constructions that he made with wood and painted gray to suggest the steel, the industrial material that was not then available in Russia, but which, you remember, Lenin had urged them to suggest in their works when he advocated that artists use contemporary materials. Now, in turning to sculpture that is building or constructing an open material form, Rodchenko was also informed by the designs of the sculptor Vladimir Tatlin, who had received the government commission to make a visual tribute for the third anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. His monument to the Third International, which you see on the left in a documentary photo, and this photo is from about 1920, and it's a photo that includes Tatlin and his insistence in front of the model, which became an icon of the Russian Revolution. And I want you to see that this became an icon of the Russian Revolution, because in the photograph in the lower right, you see how this model was actually paraded through the streets during other anniversaries of the revolution. Now, it became an icon for new artists, not only because its forms were unlike any monument previously designed, and you can just think of a typical monument of solid marble or bronze, of figures on horseback or striking military poses. But it became an icon because its oval cylindrical shapes was held up by repetitive vertical rectilinear planks that allowed the spectator to see through the monument, opening it up on all sides and making it a mythic vision of the open society that the artists, intellectuals, and even some politicians initially hoped for. Although the model was made of wood and was over 15 feet tall, the intended monument was to be built of steel and glass and rise in height to the elevation of the Eiffel Tower. Lenin had called upon artists to use forms that suggested the dynamism of the new Bolshevik government, and he admired the diagonal trajectory Tatlin had given to the model. Lenin also was impressed by the fact that this monument was not just meant to be an aesthetic object, that is, a sculpture admired from afar, but that it was also meant to be utilitarian. And we can see why Leonard admired its utilitarian qualities, because if you look at the study on the upper right, you can see in the shaded areas that in that square area on the bottom, that was meant to hold a parliamentary assembly. And in the second shaded area was meant to be party headquarters. And then on the very top, there was going to be a radio tower. In other words, every part of the building was going to have some practical use. Now, since this model was actually exhibited in the fall of 1920, it's not surprising that Catlin's approach became an inspiration to younger artists wishing to further the revolution through their works. Utilitarian, useful, practical became some of the buzzwords for young activist artists. And in these two images, one of another of Rodchenko's called Spatial Construction Number 9 from 1920-21, which is on your left, and another photograph of the artist himself standing in front of his folding constructions to reinforce the concept that these works could easily be carried from one exhibition to another, that they could be folded and easily taken from place to place. You might also notice in this photograph that Rodchenko is wearing a garment meant to emulate a worker's overall or protective clothing, as he, like Tatlin, followed Lenin's call for artists to become like engineers, productive, no longer isolated in garrets or studios, but designers, builders, or constructors for the common good. By the spring of 1921, Rodchenko and other artists had organized a group they called the First Working Group of Constructivists, and they displayed their efforts, their constructions, in a famous exhibition, which we will see photographs of later when I talk about how constructivism got to Germany. But I do want to stress right now that the first working group of constructivists not only created exhibitions, but they also wrote papers and manifestos. And I'd just like to quote to you from some of these papers, because I think they're instructive. From one of the speeches made in 1921 in Moscow, we hear, quote, "Constructivism is the product of the revolutionary search for a new consciousness in art," unquote. We also would hear that it should, that art should, quote, "reject representation and contemplation in favor of activity and production," unquote. Now, to apply these principles to productive goals, we began to see, particularly in Moscow, a number of worker artists trying to apply these principles to all sorts of practical productive means. And what we see on the screen as an example of this is Stepanova in a documentary photo having collapsed her designs, her set designs for the play Death of Tarakan. This was a performance play from 1922, and you can also see her design for a costume, which was itself inflected by the geometric abstract forms in the rectangular designs that make up the patterns on the trousers and also the shirt. Just to give you a few other examples of the attempt to apply constructivist principles to productive goods, I'm showing you on the right a stand that could be set up for a public speech. Now, this is a drawing of the stand. And over on the left, a textile that would itself use constructive principles with the hope that it could be mass-produced. Now, by the time constructivism had been declared an official movement in Russia in the spring of 1921, Lisitsky had moved to Moscow to teach in the state educational workshop, and soon he was assigned to become the emissary of the new Soviet art in the West, partially because of his facility with German, which he had learned as an architectural student in Germany before the revolution. Now, Lisitsky arrived in Berlin late in 1921, and he established with another Russian emigre, Ilya Ehrenberg, the magazine called Vesh, which you see on the screen on the left. Now, Vesh has the type means object in Russian, and it was also translated into two other languages, into French and German. And in this very first issue, which appeared in spring of 1922, Lisitsky announced that the magazine was intended to strengthen ties between Russia and the West by bringing to everyone's attention what he called, and I quote, the triumph of the constructivist method, unquote. Now, in the magazine, he called for communal activity, and he emphasized the production of objects that would help to organize everyday life. And you might notice, as you just look at the cover itself, not only how he used a bright red, which was itself one of the signs of the new Bolsheviks, but also how Lisitsky used an engineer's ruler placed on a diagonal to create a sense of energy and dynamism. And you might also look at the letters, which are very straight and precise. They happen to be hand-drawn, but you don't get a sense of any of that quality of hand-drawn, because Lisitsky wanted to suggest the mechanical type that wasn't yet available in such large letters. Now, in this very first issue, Lisitsky included photos and descriptions of the exhibition of the first working group of the constructivists, and that's over on the right. And this was the exhibit that I had just talked about that opened in Moscow in 1921. So this appeared in Germany less than a year later. In addition to including examples of that infamous exhibition in Russia, Lisitsky also included a photo and a description of Tatlin's Tower. In Germany itself, Lisitsky emphasized in the work that he started to do printed books, that is artist books, as examples of the principles of construction. Now, one of these books was called About Two Squares, and you see two pages from the printed book on the right. And I show it to you with an oil designed by Malevich on the left. Now, that oil was designed in 1915. But you can see how Lisitsky paid tribute to Malevich by using his two squares as the dominant motif in his book. Now, he had designed the book in Vitesse in 1920. But it was not published until he came to Germany in 1922. Now, this book narrates a tale of two squares, and Lisitsky, like Malevich, believed that these abstract forms could communicate to those who could read, but also to those who couldn't read. So he believed that the red square could communicate the power of communism and the black one tradition and history. And evoking filmic sequencing by the turning of the pages, this book, ostensibly for children, but it demonstrates to all how the two squares, particularly we see over in the printed page on the right, how the two squares are moving to the earth. But we see that the red one, the communist one, triumphs as the design, as the earth takes on the red color of communism. In another book published in Berlin the following year, Lisitsky brought out a collection of poems by the revered poet of the revolution, Mayakovsky. And this is a book called For the Voice, and it was meant to be read aloud. And Lisitsky explored a wide range of topographical material, using geometric letters and diagonal shapes to energize the surface and proclaim the vigor of the oral poetry. One of the most significant things he introduced from a typographical point of view is the visible index, alphabetical index, which you see over on the right of the book. In still another book, which he published with his co-editor Avesh, actually it was Ehrenberg's Six Tales with Easy Endings, and I show you on the far right the cover of this particular book. In that book, one of whose pages is called Chatwin at Work, and that's down in the bottom of the screen, Lisitsky not only referenced Tatlin's call for utilitarian goals and Malevich's geometric forms, but he also used a new technique called photomontage that he learned from the Berlin communist artist John Hartfield, whose cover for the Dada magazine of 1920, Dada 3, is on your right. Hartfield had also tried to follow Lenin's dictum of developing new forms to promote the spread of communism by combining Cubist collage with vernacular photographic portraits. He introduced the method now called photomontage, which we see on the cover, his cover, in the fragments of photos and letters cut out from the mass media and juxtaposed in overlapping nonlinear arrangements. You can see that Lisitsky used those overlapping arrangements but simplified them somewhat. And the photomontage he used is right at the very top of the page. Now, while Lisitsky remained in Berlin, his co-editor, Ehrenberg, who wrote the poems for the book, Six Tales, and Mayakovsky were able to travel between Russia, between Moscow and Berlin. And they brought back to their homeland not only samples of Lisitsky's art books, the utilitarian application of constructivist principles, but they also brought examples of Hartfield's works. And photomontage was soon taken up by the Moscow constructivists, for photography represented a medium that was technical, the use of a camera rather than a paintbrush, and was often collectively produced. That is, someone other than the photographer developed the print. Now, in this cover over on your left, it's a book of poems by Mayakovsky called About This, and the cover is designed by Rutchenko, and it was published in 1923. Here, He used constructivist principles to make the photo montage that he had seen of Hartfield, for example, more dramatic. Rodchenko enlarged the photograph of Lily Brick, that's the woman on the cover, and it's the woman Mayakovsky loved, and he also enlarged the letters and avoided too many overlapping forms. As a result, he simplified his design and made it easier to comprehend than Hartfield. Nonetheless, we see his debt to Hartfield's images of industrialization and modernity when you look particularly within the book, and I show you one page from the book, where you see a tire form right in the middle, affixed very non-narratively to a column of buildings, just as non-narratively as the tire is affixed in the Hartfield photo montage. Comparing another of Rodchenko's designs, this one on the left, and the cover for a periodical called Left of 1923, we can immediately also see Rodchenko's debt to Lisitsky's diagonals as well as to Hartfield's photo montages. Now, Lisitsky also provided assistance to emigres such as Moholy-Nagy from fallen communist regimes. And in this photograph of artists from the 1922 Congress of Constructivists and Dadas in Weimar, Germany, we actually see Lisitsky standing in front of and between Moholy-Nagy and his Czech wife, Lucia Moholy. This is probably very hard for you to see because they're in the very back. Moholy-Nagy is in the dark jacket on the right, his wife is in the last row on the left, and Lisitsky is in a kind of worker's cap with a plaid front behind the page carried by a Dutch style artist, the page of a magazine. But I just wanted you to become aware of how Lisitsky was such an important figure in Germany, helping emigres and other artists to attain a place in Germany. He was particularly helpful to Moholy-Nagy because after the failed communist revolution in Hungary, Moholy-Nagy had fled to Berlin in 1920, where he had met his wife, Lucia's photograph you had just seen. By 1922, he had managed to have a Berlin exhibition. And many works, like the oil on the left, were in that exhibition. And that's an oil itself from 1922. And what is significant is that Lisitsky praised Moholy-Nagy's work. And he praised them for their clear geometry, and furthermore, for their absorption of Russian revolutionary ideas. And when you just look at that Moholy-Nagy oil of 1922 with the Lisitsky poster, Beat the Whites with a Red Wedge, you can see why Lisitsky liked Moholy-Nagy, because he saw someone else using suprematist and constructivist forms. Examining one of Moholy-Nagy's sculptures, done also in 1922, a sculpture on the left called Nickel Sculpture, after the industrial material used, we can also see that the curving spirals in the sculpture indicate Moholy-Nagy's awareness of the open forms of Rodchenko and the Moscow constructivists, photographs which he would have seen in either in Vesh or from other emigres. Lisitsky would also have admired Moholy-Nagy's publication with another Hungarian emigre, of a 1922 collection called Book for New Artists. And he would have admired it again as one more example of the useful application of constructivist principles, particularly for Moholy Nagy's practical use of typography, photography, in reference to industrial images. Because of the praise of Luzitsky, and also for his own publication of an artist's book, Moholy Nagy was soon hired by the architect Walter Gropius, the director of the new German school for all the arts, the Bauhaus. Gropius felt the young Moholy Nagy was a promising representative of the new ideas coming out of Russia, and he assigned him to teach the famous preliminary course and to lead the metal workshop. Although Gropius was never a communist supporter, his own background as an architect and designer, along with his awareness of the utilitarian approach of much of the new Russian art, had led him to conclude that the new art curriculum at the Bauhaus should encourage students to design prototypes for industrial production. So I've shown you one of the first assignments Moholy Nagy received at the Bauhaus, and that was the cover for the 1923 exhibition catalog of Bauhaus products. And we can see why Gropius actually admired him. We can also become aware that Gropius had actually hoped to hire Luzitsky for the position. But he could see that Moholy Nagy had learned a great deal from Luzitsky's use of typography, and that's why I'm comparing the cover of the exhibition catalog of Bauhaus products with the Luzitsky cover for The Voice, which he had designed earlier in the year. And you might also just notice the similarity in the way they arrange the letters against an uncluttered background, and their use of letters in a very precise geometric manner. Moholy Nagy liked this interpretation of himself as a representative of constructivism. And we can see this in the photograph of him taken in 1925 by his wife, Lucia, where you can see that he is wearing overalls of a worker type, very much like the ones Rutchenko had himself photographed in. Most astounding, and perhaps more influential than any of the other artist books that we have seen today, was Moholy Nagy's publication of Painting, Photography, Film in 1925. It was part of the Bauhaus book series, and it was a book which contained Moholy Nagy's treatise on photography, as well as a multitude of photographs by both contemporary artists and anonymous vernacular journalists. And it was soon republished in 1927 in a second edition, which I mentioned was in the exhibition. And it's also the one that we know today in the German and English facsimile editions. If we look at one of the photo montages that Moholy Nagy included in Painting, Photography, Film, the one on the left, which he called militarism, we can see how he pays tribute to both the Russian constructivists and to the Berlin Dadaists. In the work, Militarism, you can see that Moholy Nagy is commenting on Germany's imperialist role in Africa, because he used photographs of tanks, you see up at the top, soccer players, and African natives cut out from the mass media, the newspapers and journals of the day. But you can see how he utilized these cutout photographs and organized the figures in two intersecting diagonals, which owe a great debt to the constructive designs of Tatlin and Lozitsky. And again, just for your instruction, I use the cover of Lozitsky's Vesh to remind you of the diagonal as a key organizing tool, which Moholy Nagy then employed using two different diagonals. Moholy Nagy also, in painting photography film, paid a tribute to Berlin Dada and to the female figure who contributed so much to the medium of photomontage. He included in his book the reproduction on the top of one of John Hartfield's Berlin Dada colleagues, Hannah Hoch, whose photomontage of 1924 is called The Multimillionaire, or The Double Face of the Ruling Class, just to remind everyone that millions were being earned by warfare industrialists. Although Moholy Nagy had worked with the communist government for its brief life of a mere 6 months in Hungary, he did not join a political party in Germany. Nonetheless, he explained that he wanted a collective art that could affect, and I quote, a maximum number of people, unquote. Moholy Nagy's praise and extended discussion of photography can be seen as an extension of the constructivist ideal of using painting as a medium for formal experimentation to apply for practical use. If we look at the images on the cover of his manifesto, we can see that they owe a great deal to his oil paintings of the early 20s, because for the cover, Moholy Nagy drew upon a type of photograph that he called cameraless, and we today call photogram. This is the image in the lower bottom, the lower left. And he called it cameraless because the image is not created through the use of a camera, but by exposing specially treated paper to light. He first began to experiment with cameraless photography in 1922, when he had just met Lozitsky, and was himself searching for an alternative to the uniqueness of oil painting. The photogram allowed the use of mass-produced paper, and we can also see how it also allowed him to emulate the abstract images of his suprematist, constructivist, inflected oils, which you see again in the upper right. But unlike the Moscow constructivists such as Rodchenko, Moholy Nagy never condemned the use of oil. Unlike Lozitsky as well, who stopped painting in oil in 1924, Moholy Nagy did not eliminate oil painting from his oeuvre, although he produced very few during the mid and later in 20s. Interpreting the call for new forms to awaken the masses, Moholy Nagy first turned to photograms, then to photomontages, and then to straight photographs, as we see in these two works, which appeared in the 1927 edition of Painting Photography Film. As he explained in his treatise, photography was a way of leveling class and economic differences. By producing works that were meant to be reproducible, that is, mass-produced, Moholy Nagy believed that he could help to solve the problem presented by painting as a statement of a personal idiosyncratic vision made by one individual for another individual, an approach he felt photography avoided. As he emphasized, photography was less costly than painting, and it could more dynamically transform the familiar and the ordinary to allow the viewer to experience a new way of looking at the world. Accordingly, he distanced his photographic works from traditional straight or documentary photographs by shooting from unusual angle, as we see in these two photographs. The one on the left was shot from above, and the one on the right was shot from below. By using unusual angles, Maholinaj explained in his book that he could transform the ordinary into a, quote, dynamic construction, unquote, a term that he coined in 1922 that reflects his homage to the messianic implications of Russian constructivism. In the design of the treatise itself, Maholinaj worked to produce pages that were dynamic as well by alternating bold and regular type and using circles, rectangles, and lines to set off one section from another. We see this clearly in the image on the left, which appeared in the second edition of Painting Photography Film. It was actually a section of his manuscript for a film called Dynamic of a New Metropolis. Drawing from the efforts of others, such as Lozitsky and Rodchenko, and again, we see Lozitsky in the upper right book cover, and in the lower right, the Rodchenko design for Left, or the magazine Left, in 1923, we are able to become aware how Maholinaj learned to highlight both text and vernacular photographs, which you see on the left, by vertical and horizontal black lines, as well as individual works and letters. Maholinaj called this process type photo, and he stressed that the future of public communication lay in this direction. I want to end this lecture by reminding all of us that up until recently, international constructivism has been discussed by art historians primarily as a formal and aesthetic appropriations of the techniques of Russian constructivists, particularly as interpreted by Rodchenko and his Moscow colleagues. Previously, Lozitsky had been described as an artist who had left Russia in 1921 to seek creative freedom, and as someone who was spreading. And he was not thought of as spreading the aims of communism through his through its visual culture, but merely thought of as an individual seeking creative expression. But in recent years, scholars such as Christina Lauder and Nancy Perloff believe that Lozitsky was most likely sent to Germany by the Comintern, the branch of the Soviet government dedicated to spreading communism throughout the rest of the world. I certainly agree with this assessment. I've always thought it strange that few have questioned where Lozitsky got the funds to publish a magazine and his books in Germany. In addition, more than 10 years ago, Eleanor Height critiqued the view of Maholinaj as a formalist and as a non-political person. She looked very closely at the text of Painting, Photography, and Film, as well as other published writings from the 20s, and concluded that he, like Lozitsky, also used constructive principles first developed in the Soviet Union, but used them to try to communicate to a much broader range of spectators and citizens than previously had been thought possible. Constructivism, then, was meant to be international, and it was meant to be messianic. As you move through the exhibition, if you have not yet seen it, you, of course, will be aware that although the works of Lozitsky, Rodchenko, and Maholinaj, particularly their artist books, did not prevent the turmoil of communism or even fascism, their determination to find a new visual culture that could be spread widely through inexpensive means, particularly through the artist's book, has wildly changed how we value photography, film, advertisements, and other artifacts of mass culture today. Thank you. If anyone has questions about any of this material, I'd be glad to try to answer. If you want to turn on the light, sure. Then I can see you. Yes. Lazitsky had gone back to Russia. I mentioned that very quickly. He'd gone back in 1926. He was allowed to come back and forth between Russia and Germany. But then as Stalin came to, increased his hold over all the artistic unions in the Soviet. He remained in Russia, and he died there in 1941. Moholy-Nagy, you might want to know what happened to him when Hitler came to power, because he was in Germany. And Moholy-Nagy was of Jewish background, and although he had converted to Protestantism in 1919 when he joined the revolution in Hungary, nonetheless, the National Socialists thought of him as Jewish, and he tried to emigrate, and he did, first to England, and then he came to the United States, and he helped to establish a school outside of Chicago, but unfortunately he died in 1947. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your presentation. It's very provocative one. I want to just explore what the quote that you made from Lazitsky, where he spoke about the triumph of Russian constructivism. And to use another phrase that you've heard, the inflections that you spoke of really were inflections of his work in German. But what about the resonance of Russian constructivism, if indeed there was a triumph of Russian constructivism?
Well,
how far did this triumph extend geographically? Because you also, in the beginning of your talk, spoke about the movement of Russian constructivism westward. Did it reach America?
Well, eventually, I mean, that's a good question, because eventually you do have it reach America. Louis Lozowick, who was a Russian, had actually adopted some of these constructivist principles and brought them to the United States in the later 20s. And you do find Hungarians, less so Czech artists, but certainly many Czech artists, and also Polish artists at that time, emulating these constructivist ideas. And of course, as you see, if you look through the exhibition, you will see many book covers, many journals where there was a use of constructivist ideas. But I'd just like to go back for a moment to your bringing up Lazitsky and the magazine Vesh, which was his first tool for communicating constructivist ideas into Germany. And the essay in which he talked about the triumph of constructivism and constructivist ideas was really the first essay in that magazine. And he was very excited when he wrote that essay, because the blockade of the West that had prevented many of the books and artworks that were being developed in the Soviet Union by a small group, I must emphasize, it's a small group of intellectuals, nonetheless, With Lisitsky bringing these examples through photographs into Germany with that new magazine, he was able to publicize this new style and to talk about geometric abstract art as representing a messianic vision of a new world. I don't know if I've answered your question. And that idea that a visual work could have an impact on the public's consciousness was what excited so many other artists, even if they weren't followers of communism, as Moholy-Nagy was not, although he agreed with the general principles of communism, but he was more in line with what we might call socialism today. Yeah. No, happy to.
Your terminology, art as a book, or art as books, when this term is, at least I thought, is normally used, one is talking about something that is not mechanically reproduced as a journal or even some of the books that you show, but something that is almost a cameo or a handmade or a limited print on the work of
Yeah, you can have artist books. That term, I mean, I believe it could be applied to artist books that are particularly personal, have to do with a particular personal expression, the artist perhaps being commissioned to design a book for a publisher for someone's poems. But if you take something like For the Voice, Mayakovsky was seen as one of the great poets at that time, in the 20s, of the Russian Revolution. So for someone like Lisitsky to be able to design a book with Mayakovsky was a way of taking the personal and making it productive, and that is something that could then be used for the common good. So I am broadening the term artist book to include ones that might even be called propaganda. And I don't think we have to limit artist book to, say, hand-done ones, because after all, Moholy-Nagy's book is completely photomechanically produced. And so were actually all the books that I'm discussed today. Yeah, in the back.
Yeah. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the relationship between constructivist as a more sculptural material movement and the images and layouts that you designed here. Is there any like cross influence here? Because I know when I thought of constructivism, I thought it was trying to pull a functional object directly from the material itself and trying to
Yeah, exactly. That's what Moholy-Nagy was doing, for example, in the nickel sculpture. That is, he's trying to relate to the malleable material that the material will allow. And at the same time, he is aware of what the constructivists in the Soviet Union were emphasizing, that is, use what was formerly considered an artwork, painting or sculpture, use that to find the forms, and then use those forms in something that is productive or useful, the way Tatlin did. In other words, Tatlin's work was abstract, non-figurative, not like anything from the past. And yet, at the same time, the fact that it was open was a sign of the what the communists believed that communism could become, an open society. And also that forward motion was a further sign of how the artwork could give a sign of propulsion, dynamism for the movement.
And so this translates from a sculptural form to this image.
Well, the book, it's the general theoretical idea of forms being useful and utilitarian. And the emphasis in some way was first on the actual materials, that is, using industrial materials. But there was almost no industrial materials they could use in Soviet Union in 1920. I mean, there was very little steel or iron available. So they first tried to work out their ideas in three-dimensional form. And then, that with an emphasis on material. And then they applied those ideas to something they felt was practical, whether it was set design, textiles, books, or monuments. It could be anything, as long as it wasn't meant to be isolated, meant to just represent the artist's expression. It had to meld with the common good or be for the common good. You had a question. Yeah. Yeah, I think it certainly did, and because of time, I certainly I really left out how Lozitsky and Moholy-Nagy also drew from, in addition to Berlin Dada, drew from other movements in Europe, particularly from the Dutch Gestalt movement. And that would have been one other source, certainly, for Moholy-Nagy's concept of dynamic constructivism. But, I mean, you notice he used the term constructivism. And he is in some way aligning himself philosophically more with the Russians than, say, with the Dutch. Yeah. I'm so sorry, I can't hear.
I saw a series of paintings
by Lozitsky. Yes.
Could you comment on how those fit in?
Well, the term Proun is meant to be affirmation of the new. And he did those paintings when he was in Vitesse with Malevich. And so these are paintings that are primarily abstract and geometrical. And they also rely on some of his background as an architect. So they have a look of architect's drawings, which melded very nicely with Malevich's paintings. But he stopped really painting after 1924. And unlike Moholy-Nagy, who still did some paintings, Lozitsky completely stopped because in the Soviet Union, painting was thought to be something elite, elitist, a solitary work for a solitary artist, and it could only be for one person. Something like an artist's book could be reproduced. And anything that could be for more than one person could then be valued. And in the early years, what was valued were works that combined the newness of Malevich's abstraction in the geometric forms and melded that with the practical. Are there any other questions? Yeah.
Are these works
were
signed?
Were these works signed?
Right.
Well, some of them were. But if you look, I mean, they're in books. And generally in the books, like the Lozitsky for the Voice, it's very clear that poems are by Mayakovsky. His name is right actually on the cover. And when you open it up, it says, constructed by Lozitsky. So yes, in the beginning, certainly there was recognition of the individual artists who designed them, that desire to be recognized is hard to eliminate. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you all very much. And
all right, thank you.